It was just a blip on the screen in Dr. Sarah Myhill's career, but when the British version of the American Medical Association wanted to question her about her medical practice, they ended up with this written on the case record. The problem with the Myhill case is that all her patients are improved and refuse to give witness statements. She's a brilliant doctor, has written the brilliant book Ecological Medicine, which I hope will find its way onto all of your shelves at home. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Sarah, in the mid-1700s to early 1800s, Robert Mathias was only one of the people who gave us a foreshadowing and stated that a population will outgrow its resources and disease and other catastrophes will inevitably lead to checks on human population growth. We're here, and thankfully so are you and your book, Ecological Medicine.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think I predict an apocalyptic future for humans because what we are doing is not sustainable.
Yes.
What we're doing with this planet is not sustainable. And what we are doing with modern medicine is not sustainable. And we have to revert back to much more ecological principles so that we can live our lives in harmony with this planet, not fighting it, because to fight it will destroy the planet and will destroy human beings.
Yes. And chapter one of Ecological Medicine is entitled The Inquisitive Doctor. Was there any one incident that got you to be a magnifying glass carrying Sherlock Holmes type of medical professional?
There absolutely was. It was one of the worst things that ever happened to me in my life. My firstborn, Ruth, of course, I was recently qualified, so I had all the latest science and I was going to be the best mother in the world. And of course, what happened? She screamed and she screamed and she screamed. She had the most diabolical colic. And I looked through all the medical textbooks. I researched it as well as I could in those days before internet, of course, and I couldn't find a reason for that. And so I started experimenting myself. And when I gave up dairy products, not only did my snotty nose, asthma, chronic sinusitis clear up, but her colic cleared up overnight. And it was a life-changing moment for me. A, because, she was a transformed baby. Instead of being irritable, tearful, so she couldn't sleep, I couldn't sleep, and it was a misery, she turned into a happy little girl who slept solidly through the night. And the second thing is, it made me realize that modern, conventional medicine, there's a big hole in it. It didn't look at food allergy as a major driver of disease. So I got into all this through food allergy, and allergy is a major cause of pathology, irritable bowel syndrome, migraine, eczema, asthma is so often driven by food allergy. And nowhere is that to be found in the medical textbooks. Not now, not then, and certainly not in the near future.
Yes, and your book is so reader-friendly for us average Joes to help ourselves. And then, if we need to, we can call in the pros. And you draw a roadmap from symptoms to mechanisms to diagnosis and treatment. Can you share an example of using this pathway?
Well, what we have to remember is that everything starts with symptoms. And symptoms are the body and the brain's way of saying to us something is wrong. You are not doing something right. And you have got to change your ways. And the symptom, and we don't like changing our ways. We don't like changing our diet. We don't like to. And so symptoms have to be very powerful and very unpleasant to make us change our ways.
Yes.
So the example I've just given, my daughter crying all night, chronic sleeplessness, was a very powerful incentive for me to change my ways. And I have changed my diet. Guess what? I loved dairy products. And in fact, that is a characteristic of allergy. Very often, the person loves the food to which they are reacting allergically. It's as if they're addicted to it. So the example I've just given you is a perfect example of how that works. But another example would be arthritis. Arthritis is a very painful condition. It stops you doing things. It stops you sleeping. But so much arthritis is allergy to microbes from the fermenting gut. And what that means is if you do a low carbohydrate diet, as often as not, you can cure your arthritis. And fine, I'm dealing with a young woman recently, 39-year-old walker, did a lot of walking, suddenly found she was unable to walk great distance because of pain in her right hip. Now, she did a very low carbohydrate diet, cut out the major allergens, and she's now back to walking her normal, you know, 15, 20 miles at weekends. So, you know, it's, as I say, it's following, it's like, you know, seeing a patient is like going, arriving at a crime scene. And when you arrive at that crime scene, there are lots of clues dotted all over the place. And the last thing you want is somebody walking over that crime scene prescribing symptom-suppressing medication. Because symptom-suppressing medication takes away those clues and it takes away that incentive for change. So people who take painkillers, let's say, for arthritis, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, okay, in the short term, the pain goes away and they can walk. But if you walk on a joint that is inflamed or a malfunction, you will damage it even more. You know, pain is nature's way of saying, stop walking, you know. Stop working. Stand back. Ask the question, why have you got that pain? You take pain suppressing medication and you lose that clue and you lose the incentive to change. But worst of all, you accelerate the underlying pathology.
Yes, yes. And you tell us about diagnoses and you write that doctors and thus patients routinely confuse the making of diagnoses with merely the description of symptoms and clinical pictures. It's such a noteworthy difference to make.
It's such an important distinction because a clinical picture is that. It's a clinical picture. So, for example, if I see a patient with Parkinson's disease, that has a very typical clinical picture with tremor, rigidity, stiffness of movement, slowness of thought, and so on. But Parkinson's is just a clinical picture. We then have to ask the question why. Now, they may have Parkinson's because it's a well-recognized side effect of some drugs, of dopamine blockers. So the major tranquilizers, for example, can present with Parkinson's in that patient because that's what they do. They block dopamine production. It may be symptomatic of organophosphate poisoning because organophosphate destroys that part of the brain. It may be symptomatic of a prion disorder, and we know prions are infectious particles that can be passed on. So we can't, you know, if you have a patient with Parkinson's, you also have to think about the cause of that, because there's a possibility that you could reverse that person's Parkinson's by identifying the cause. And that is a true diagnosis, i.e. the mechanism. If you can establish the mechanism by which that person has developed their dementia, their Parkinson's or whatever, then, of course, it's easy to treat because you know the mechanism. It's just like an engineer. If an engineer is presented with a structural problem, i.e. a bridge is weak or a road is collapsing, he asks the question, why is that road collapsing? What is it? Is it metal fatigue? You know, is it being undermined? Are the foundations going? He identifies what the problem is, and then he fixes that with some sort of, you know, intervention, a building intervention to sort it. But for some reason, that thinking process, which of course is how we solve all problems, yes, not just engineering problems or medical problems, but all problems of the human race. You know, if we get back to that style of thinking, then we could revolutionize medicine overnight.
Yes, and that's the genius of it all. I feel like at this stage in your life, you could almost change careers and become a bridge engineer or a true Sherlock Holmes. It's the same deductive processing that goes on, isn't it?
Correct. I'm quite sure I couldn't become a bridge engineer, but as you rightly point out, the deductive process is exactly the same. What are the symptoms? Why have we got those symptoms? What are the mechanisms? And that leads logically to interventions to cure that. And those interventions are difficult, and people, you know, are often resistant to making major lifestyle changes, yes, with their diet or how they live their lives or whatever. But that is the way to properly cure somebody who has a problem.
Yes. And doctors certainly can serve as an interface between good science and the art of healing. You begin with Groundhog Basic. What can we learn here?
Okay. The regimes that I use to treat patients are very standard. There's nothing clever about them. And the starting point to treat people with whatever disease process they come along with is exactly the same. And because these, I keep coming back and talking about these processes over and over again, I call them groundhog regimes. I call them groundhog regimes after the comedy film Groundhog Day, where our hero comes back. Yeah, it's a And essentially, there are three levels of groundhog regimes that I talk about. Now, what we should all be doing all the time is groundhog basic. And groundhog basic is how we should live our lives to stop ourselves getting into trouble in the first place. Diet, supplements, lifestyle regime, sleep, sunshine, exercise, all that sort of stuff. But guess what? Nobody comes to me, you know, I've never had a 17-year-old come to me and say, like, I'd like to live my life to its full potential and blah, 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 and put in place. It's never happened because, of course, all 17-year-olds, as we know, are immortal. They don't need to pay. But groundhog basic is what we should all be doing in theory. And then we have groundhog acute. And groundhog acute is what we should be doing in the event of an acute infection. And of course, I have been employing that massively over the last couple of years because this is how we treat acute COVID infection. And then nutrition interventions to get rid of the virus, put the immune system in tip-top shape so it's a short-lived illness or maybe no illness at all and recovery is assured. And then thirdly, we have groundhog chronic. And groundhog chronic is the starting point to treat all chronic disease. And of course, and that's how people present to me. They come to me because they have unpleasant symptoms, which might be chronic fatigue syndrome. It might be arthritis with pain. It might be fibromyalgia. It might be inflammatory bowel disease or whatever. They've come with a chronic disease and they've done the rounds of doctors and they are no better. They may have received some symptom-suppressing medication, but the underlying pathology is progressing apace. And groundhog chronic is how we start off treating those patients. And, of course, there are huge overlaps between these regimes. Groundhog basic is the simplest one. Groundhog acute is, oh, well, with a few extra bolt-ons. And then groundhog chronic is the whole shooting match, you know, the whole package of diet, supplements, fermenting gut, and then specifics for specific problems.
Is there something that feels just so common sense to you that you're surprised that it's new information to either your clients or what's going on in the world today?
Yes, absolutely. It's diet. It's food. It's what we put down our throats. And food is the single most important determinant of well-being and disease. I mean, you've heard the saying, and he's eating himself to his grave. You know, he's digging his grave with his knife and fork. And we know you can see the people who aren't healthy. You can see the unhealthy diets that they consume. And they consume unhealthy diets are those diets which are full of what we call junk food, sugars and carbohydrates. And the reason people eat those sort of foods is because they are addictive. And those foods, addictive substances of any description, alcohol, smoking, caffeine, it doesn't matter what. All addictive substances in the short term relieve our symptoms. And we use those addictions to deal with that nasty, unpleasant symptom of stress. And if you are using addiction to deal with stress, then you are on the slippery slope downhill. And some addictions are obvious, alcohol addiction is obvious, nicotine addiction is obvious, you know, they calm us down, they help us deal with stress. But the least obvious addiction, but the most pernicious, the one that isn't recognised, the one that's cheap, convenient and easy, is sugar and refined carbohydrates.
Yes.
And we go for those foods in the short term because they relieve those terrible symptoms of stress. And worse than that, if we don't have those foods, if we don't have our regular sugar fix or that carbohydrate fix, we get withdrawal symptoms and they're awful too. So it really is a very pernicious and vicious cycle. And I do understand addiction. I do get it. I do feel for those people who have such stressed lives, they can only control their symptoms, you know, with some sort of addiction. But it really is, say, the slippery slope to ill health, and recognizing that these foods are the problem that they are is a very, very important first step to controlling those addictions and changing one's diet.
Are there any supplements that are a regular part of the regime when working with someone or if someone is trying to stop an addiction?
Absolutely, yes. And this applies not just to people with addictions. This applies across the board because The problem is that agriculture, chemical agriculture over the last several decades,
oh, yes.
since the Second World War, the quality of soil has declined, you know, rapidly.
Yes.
You know, pre-Second World War, maybe soil analysis, you'd find 500 parts per million of minerals in the soil. Now, for those soils, it's less than 50 parts. So the soils themselves are becoming grossly deficient in magnesium, zinc, copper, selenium, chromium, all the essential minerals the soils are made up from. And, of course, that passes through into the food chain, into the vegetables, into the grains, into the animals that feed, and, of course, into humans. So we should all consume a good multivitamin with a good multimineral and maybe some essential fatty acids. You know, we should all be doing that as a matter of course. And then there are two other very particular problems that are peculiar to us humans. The first is that we spend most of our lives indoors. No other animal does that.
Right. Unless you're a farm cow or a farm.
Well, they're not proper wild animals, are they?
No, they're not.
But proper wild animals live outside. When they live outside, they get sunshine on their skin. And with sunshine on the skin, they can make vitamin D. But humans, no chance. We live indoors. You know, where I'm living here, it's too cold. And you won't find me sunbathing in my bikini today, I can tell you that. Apart from the fact it's not a pretty sight. But the point is, we are all going to be vitamin D deficient. Vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin. And I do lots of nutritional tests. And I have to say, I have never seen a normal level of vitamin D, or what I consider a normal level of vitamin D, in somebody who is not taking a vitamin D supplement. Deficiency is pandemic. That's the first problem.
Do you see, though, that the vitamin D is actually absorbed and used properly, as one would get from the sun?
Oh, well, certainly blood levels come up pretty reliably well when you're taking vitamin D.
Okay, good.
What's key to vitamin D is it's a fat-soluble vitamin, and you can only absorb vitamin D if you're eating fatty foods. And the shocking thing is we have this ridiculous mantra that high-fat diets cause high cholesterol, which causes heart disease, which is nonsense. It's nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. But we see all these people who've been brainwashed
yes.
into eating low-fat diets, thinking that's the healthy option. And as a result, they're not going to absorb their fat-soluble vitamins either. Now, of course, you know, when I put people on a paleo-ketogenic diet, that is a diet which is rich in fat and fiber. They are the two key fuels with which we should be powering our body. And therefore, lots of fat in the diet means that they will absorb that vitamin D well and restore their blood levels. I mean, yes, it would be ideal if we could all sunbathe on a daily basis and get our vitamin D naturally. But, you know, I can tell you, I live in Wales. It's cold here. It's cloudy. It's impossible for anybody living in Wales.
Yes, I've been there. I do understand that. And I guess I live in a bubble because I feel like, oh, yes, most people know what kind of fats are good for you. But then I find out that for the majority, that isn't quite true. So I need to have folks like you helping and reminding what really does need to be done. And you write that answers to caring for the elephants in the room, chronic fatigue being one, brought unexpected light on other common medical problems such as cancer and heart disease and dementia. How did that present to you?
It just came out of working with patients and in general practice, because when I was started off in general practice, which was in the early 1980s, there was no treatment for chronic fatigue syndrome or nothing tangible. And so many people suffered from that. In fact, at that time, the complaint of TATT, tired all the time, that's the acronym that the doctors use, there was no effective treatment for that, other than common sense things like, well, don't work so hard and get more sleep.
Yeah,
but
yes,
that
yes.
wasn't really getting at the root cause, was it, you know? And so that's why I started getting interested in that. And, of course, the first aspect of that, allergy, I was interested in allergy, and many people with allergies had fatigue. So I knew that allergy was one cause of fatigue. And yes, I got some patients, you know, better by avoiding foods like gluten, grains and dairy products because they often drive fatigue. But I knew that was just a small part of the story. Again, chronic fatigue syndrome or ME is multifactorial. There's more than one thing going on. And, you know, fast forwarding to the present day, I then started looking at people with chronic fatigue syndrome. Essentially, they've got poor energy delivery mechanisms. Their bodies are not good at generating energy. And we have to ask the question, why should that be? So I focus, say, my attention on energy delivery mechanisms. And in fact, I did original research together with Dr. John McLaren Howard that demonstrated that mitochondria, which are organelles within every living cell, not just in our bodies, but in the whole of the natural world, mitochondria are how we generate energy in the body. And so I looked at chronic fatigue syndrome from a mitochondrial perspective. And for those mitochondria to work well, first of all, you've got to put the right fuel in the tank. So the mitochondria are like the engines of our car. You know, engines are what take fuel from the fuel tank, burn it in the presence of oxygen to generate energy for that car to go. And it's exactly the same in humans. Look at the mitochondrial engine. And the preferred fuel of mitochondria are ketones. And we get ketones from fat and we get ketones from the fermentation of fiber in the large bowel. And that is how humans have been powering themselves for hundreds of thousands of years. And that is how virtually all animals in the natural world power themselves. The vegetarians, they power themselves from fiber because, you know, my horse, for example, eats lots of grass and hay. And she ferments that hay and that fiber in her huge gut to generate short-chain fatty acids, which are ketone bodies. So she functions best running on ketones. And all the endurance horses are fed hay, often soaked in oil, in order to increase their fat content. So we have our mitochondrial engine. We then have to put the right fuel in the tank, and that's all right, eating a ketogenic diet. And then that mitochondrial engine has certain essentials that it needs. So just like your engine needs a spark plug or a compression chamber, it needs air filters, it needs an exhaust system, it needs proper timing. So do our mitochondria need essential nutrients to make sure they function well. So we can supply those, and they're fairly easy to do. That's easy to do. And then we have to look at the control mechanism. We have to look at the thyroid accelerator pedal and the adrenal gearbox. So, you know, you could have a Formula One car with a magnificent engine and rocket fuel coming into it, but with no accelerator pedal, with no proper gearbox, it's not going to even get off the starting blocks. So we then look at those two aspects. And that really, that simple model really encompasses the energy delivery mechanisms that are so often deficient in patients with fatigue syndrome. And if that doesn't cure, if that doesn't restore their normal athletic prowess, if they can't get back to work as a result of doing that, then that tells me there must be a hole in their energy bucket. They must be spending energy wastefully. And there are two common holes in the energy bucket, as I call it. One is the emotional hole.
Yes.
If people are chronically anxious and they've got circular thoughts going round, then yes, that can be exhausting. But the big one, the one that comes up time and time and time again, is the immunological hole in that energy bucket. And our immune system is our standing army. It's our immune system that protects us from foreign invasion, i.e. chronic infection. But so if the immune system is chronically activated because that person is infected with something, or if the immune system is chronically activated because that person is reacting allergically, and that's the mechanism by which allergy causes fatigue, or if it's activated because of autoimmunity, i.e. the immune system is fighting itself, that's civil war, that's very bad news, then, as I say, that will all kick holes in the energy bucket. And from the clinical picture of that patient, you can get a pretty good idea what it is going on. And if that person has some sort of chronic inflammation, so they feel ill, they're running fevers, their lymph nodes are swollen, they've got symptoms of pain, muscle aching, arthritis, you know, then that's typical of chronic inflammation. The immune system is busy. We then have to ask the question why.
This is such brilliant information you're sharing. Thank you so much. Sarah, one thing that I read in your book that I just absolutely loved was that you just always expect to see miracles in your patients. And that's so brilliant. You're not the kind of doctor that'll say, well, I'm sorry, you have 3 months to go because of all these statistics. So is there a miracle or a favorite miracle you could share with us?
Oh, well, the one I always love to tell is a little girl, but she's about 4 years old. She had stuffy nose and catarrh and blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, of course, it's often due to dairy allergy, and let's start with a dairy-free diet. And this little girl wasn't responding in any way. And I said to mum, you know, is she a bit quiet? Oh, no, she said she's stone deaf. She's been diagnosed with deafness since birth, put on a dairy-free diet, and her hearing was restored. So there was a little girl who was going to be deaf for life, and hearing was to return, and she now works as a solicitor, very bright girl, and she's got a busy practice in Birmingham. So, you know, that was a miracle story for me, and that was very early on in my career, which I suppose is what is why that stuck. I mean, medicine should be fun. It should be the most exciting profession that's possible to do, because the interventions that one is making are transformative.
Yes.
You can literally turn people around. I mean, the athletes, you put a long distance runner on a ketogenic diet and you can turn that runner from an also ran into a medal holding position.
Amazing.
And that's just for the top athletes. And at the other end of the scale, you can have somebody who has been bedbound for decades go out and walk again. In fact, I have a lovely girl out in Ireland who sent me a video of her getting on a horse and riding the horse without help, you know, for the first time ever. So, amazing. You know, we see miracles every day. Now, that doesn't mean I can guarantee to cure every person. Of course I can't. But what I can do is I can give them, as I call it, the rules of the game and the tools of the trade so they can do it themselves.
Another thing you wrote was that ideas and advice in medicine and for you will not stand still, and they can't.
I feel as if I'm on an exponential curve for learning that's getting steeper and steeper, because I'm learning new stuff all the time that's just so interesting.
Yes. Now, is there something glaring that I've missed in asking you for a 30-minute interview here today?
Well, the one other essential groundhog regime. So everybody listening to this, and that should include vitamin C. Now, we haven't talked about vitamin C, but the reason that vitamin C is so important for humans is that we can't make our own vitamin C. So my little dog who's sitting next to me, if she got an infection, her body can make up to 20 grams of vitamin C over 24 hours to deal with that infection. That's 20,000 milligrams of vitamin C.
Amazing.
Vitamin C deals with infection beautifully. What we do know is vitamin C is normally made from a sugar molecule. A little bit of sugar is essential, you know, in the diet. From the sugar molecule, it's normally a four enzyme step to make vitamin C. I say all other mammals have that facility, and we lost it somewhere down the line during evolution, which was a big evolutionary error. But we can compensate for that. We can make our own vitamin C, and we should all be taking at least 5 grams of vitamin C daily. That's 5,000 milligrams. And the way to take that is make up your water bottle in the morning, put in your 5 grams of ascorbic acid. If you don't like the acid flavor or you're worried about your teeth, add a little bit of alkali like magnesium carbonate to neutralize that. And drink that little and often through the day.
Lovely.
Now, if you do that, I can almost guarantee that you will not get COVID.
What a love. And a brilliant doctor, Sarah Myhill, author of Ecological Medicine. There is an interview we did with her years ago, also on our archives, which can be found, as well as anything Tributaries related, at tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are in the usual spots. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.